105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, agents, editors, and other people who bring us books. Write the Book has been on the air every Saturday morning for the better part of a year. As of right now, the show moves to Monday afternoons from 2 to 3. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear two interviews. The first with the writer Robert Vivian, and then a conversation with Burlington business owner Norbert Ender. First up, a conversation with Robert Vivian. Essayist, poet, playwright, novelist, and short story writer Robert Vivian grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. He's had over 20 plays produced off and off Broadway. His essay collection, Cold Snap as Yearning, won the Society of Midland Authors Award for Nonfiction and the Nebraska Book Award for Nonfiction. He was a finalist for the 2004 Iowa Short Fiction Award. His novel, The Mover of Bones, the first of three books in a trilogy, was published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2006. He's an assistant professor of English at Alma College in Michigan. When I spoke to Robert in December, I asked him what inspired his book, The Mover of Bones, and the trilogy that it's a part of.
That's a really good question. An agent recommended that I try writing a novel, and I had never even thought of that before. I just didn't think I had that fictional gear. And her encouragement kind of gave me permission to dive in. And I started the book, the image of this alcoholic janitor descending into the basement of a church. That was the trigger. And that opening scene really gave me license to kind of blow open the book. I had a sense that he was going to take her body and then across the country and encounter people. So just that trajectory, I knew that it'd be kind of multivocal novel, and that people would have their own encounter, their own experience with the janitor and the dead girl. Mm-hmm. Some of them quite straightforward, some of them quite mystical, some of them quite glancing. You know, it's more of hearing about them. Mm-hmm. And so that's how the book began, and I didn't realize that I was working on a trilogy until I started working on another novel, and it was not the same material or the same characters, but it was the same geography. I hadn't written Nebraska out of my system. I don't think I ever will. But all three books are located in Nebraska. Uh-huh. And that's really the unifying element. And the other one is they're all told in voices. Mover has the most voices, and then the next book, Lambright Saviors, has fewer voices, and then the last book, Another Burning Kingdom, has even fewer. So.
And have you written all three? Or?
Yeah, and I think they're ready to go. My editor, you know, she may differ on that point. But they're in the queue at University of Nebraska Press. So uh-huh. In the next couple of years, they should be coming out.
Now, you said an agent suggested that you work on a novel, so did that agent already represent you in another sense?
Yeah, she read the first book, Cold Snap as Yearning, and
which is your essays.
Essays, yeah, and she took me on because of that, and so I'm still fairly new at the fiction, short fiction and long fiction, about 8 years now, mm-hmm. And now I'm pretty much with a few essays working exclusively on novels.
Huh, yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about structuring The Mover of Bones, and within the idea of a trilogy, once you realized you had a trilogy, the structure of that kind of arc?
Sure, yeah. My earlier incarnation as a writer was up as a playwright, and so for a good decade I wrote nothing but plays, mm-hmm. and many of them were done in very, very small venues in New York for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks and then gone forever. And so I've been working in monologue for a long time. And once I knew, for example, that they were going on the road, so to speak, the janitor and the dead girl, that they'd have to meet people along the way. And I kind of thought, well, wouldn't it be kind of interesting if they gave kind of testimonials to that encounter? And so that was really the kind of the inner outline, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically driven by monologue. And that was the structure for Mover of Bones.
Mm-hmm.
Initially it was many more voices. And my editor is very, very good. She, Ladette Randolph at Nebraska, I had to pull back, you know. So I went way overboard on that. And that's, I thought, well, a trilogy driven by kind of first-person narratives was another unifying principle for all three books.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't realize that until I had written part two. This is kind of confusing, Shayla. So I wrote an entire novel only to realize it wasn't going to fit in the trilogy.
Oh.
So I had to jettison that book.
Oh, how painful.
Well, you know, it was highly experimental. And some of the tenor of that book, it was called The Bomb Maker's Son, about a domestic terrorist, ended up in the last book, Another Burning Kingdom. So, you know, it's all grist for the mill, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So you know how it is to kind of grope your way through a huge project like this. And when I finally realized, okay, this is what I think I'm doing, then things became a little more streamlined. And the last book came very quickly, Another Burning Kingdom.
And you said you went from quite a lot of voices to fewer and then fewer.
Yeah.
Are you kind of focusing in on certain characters that we've seen before, or are you just introducing new characters within each of the books?
Yeah, completely new characters.
Always new. Okay.
Yeah. But it's Nebraska, western Nebraska, and fictionalized towns in Nebraska. And it's just that part of the country, western, is just breathtaking. It's beautiful. And post-trilogy, I think the fiction is... I think I've moved on from Nebraska. I don't know if that's entirely true. The new novel that I'm working on is set in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's amazing how... I don't know if this makes sense, but I had to reckon with growing up in Nebraska somehow, my experience of it as
mm-hmm.
a geography.
Mm-hmm.
So landscape and voice, I think, are the two things that are most, are the connecting threads in the trilogy.
In The Mover of Bones, there's a kind of desperate nature to Jesse's quest and to the other characters' stories of a lot of them have a lot of anguish and sometimes hope. Did you intend that intensity of pacing? I'm using the word desperate. I'm not quite sure if it's the right
yeah.
word, but
I think that's a very good word.
Oh.
yes, I in the writing of it and in the rereading and the revision of it, I sense that desperation too, so I think that's very accurate. And as I was working on it, I was in transit, really, between Nebraska and Michigan. So I was on the highway a lot. And I had a lot of time to think about the book in terms of how important the highway is
mm-hmm.
in the novel. It's not mentioned overtly, but you know he's moving. They're moving across the country. And autobiographically, I was too. And I was, you know, you would see people on the side of the highway sometimes, and I would think of Jesse. So I kind of, and I forget who said, I lived in that kind of fictive dream for quite a while
mm-hmm.
in the writing of this book. And in the desperation that you mentioned, he was also being pursued, you know, by the law,
right,
and his own demons.
Right.
And so maybe that lent impetus to that kind of desperation.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's a failure of the novel in the sense that he never does end up anywhere in particular. He's still in transit. And so the desperation, I think it goes throughout the whole novel.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
This might be a good time for you to read something from your work.
Oh, okay. this is from a recent essay about writing. It's called The Ecstasy of Paragraphs.
This is Robert Vivian.
Sometimes I wake after midnight and go downstairs in order to listen, though I don't know what I'm listening for. I walk down the dark outline of stairs and pause at the landing between floors, letting this old house fill me with its perpetual and waiting presence that always seems on the verge of an ancient groan. My hand resting on the banister where the cats have tried to scratch away the ghosts they've rightly become heir to. I'm not sure what makes me wake or draws me down in so ritualistic and fatal a fashion almost every early morning, but I need it like a church nonetheless. The people I've loved or who have loved me are all around in molecules of air that have long escaped their names. Not a crowd, but a movement of hush so vacant and profound it ushers in the certain belief that nothing more is required, only given and received. Because I'm between lights, I make my way in the dark with the bare branches of trees mapping the windows in shaking braids of tentative abandon, and auspices and guidance for which I'm always grateful. Someone's in the corner, but it's no longer a person, just the echo of a presence that has long ago decided to stay on and endure the seasons and passing days that give way to these early and holy hours. Then putting the coffee on and waiting for it to percolate becomes an interval in a lifetime that results in a slow burning and daily consummation, the kind that will lead back to fire or water or some other element hewn out of the stars. I can hardly dare to confess that the ecstasy of paragraphs is waiting for me as my wife continues to sleep with the golden filaments of her hair spread out across the pillow. The furnace in the basement bound to kick in any minute as I sit at my desk once more above a heating grate, waiting for the updraft of warm rising air that must be accorded its place among the greatest subtle pleasures of this world. I don't know what the paragraphs will say or what they'll want from me by way of arrangement or utterance, but I can sense their approximate length and tones I have committed my life to, the tones that often make the rest of the day a series of errands and obligations that simply don't have the same depth or urgency as these same paragraphs that every now and then even manage to bring me to my knees when they have come out of the true dark silence of winter and the true dark silence of myself.
Thank you very much. You mentioned that you've started writing a lot more fiction than essay.
Mm-hmm.
So you're working on this. Do you miss essay very much? Or?
I've always regarded the essay as a wonderful reprieve from other work.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always turn to them. When they come, I'm quite happy to depart from the main work at hand and work on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't, they're indirect work for me. They're not, I don't really set out to write essays. I wait for them to happen.
Yeah.
My first book, I didn't intend to. This is a book I'm working on. It was more of many, many different essays. That
is that called Snap?
Yeah.
As Yearning?
Uh-huh. And my good friend editor, Ladette, she said one day to me, because I had been publishing a number of them, she said, "How many do you have?" And I said, "Well, let me see." And 30, I think. And she said, "Why don't you arrange them and bring them to me?" And she was the editor at Nebraska at the time, and that's how the book came into being. So mm-hmm. I didn't say, "Well, I'm working on a book of essays." They came together, mm-hmm. and the book came together really in a rather wonderful way.
I heard you give a lecture recently about the meditative essay, writing the meditative essay, and you said, please don't call them personal. And I enjoyed that. I really did. But I wonder if you can, and I know that you talked quite a lot about that, and maybe it's hard to boil it down, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the difference between what you consider meditative essay versus what people call personal essay.
Sure, yeah. For me, the meditative essay, it just takes the personal as a kind of launching pad. And ultimately, the essay transcends the self to subjects that I think are more universal. And the self, of course, is absolutely necessary for the liftoff, so to speak. But they go somewhere beyond personal, immediate experience, what Annie Dillard does so well mm-hmm. in so many of her essays. It's hard to find her sometimes, except for the incredible cadence of her individual voice, you know, and the way she makes music in the essay. But what's happening to her? You know, we see her walking down and looking at wildlife in a ravine, but then, oh, now it's about nature, life and death, the cosmos. So I really love writers who do that, because they inspire me, and they charge the page with something that isn't just about themselves, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah. And later in that lecture, you mentioned something that I think is relevant to what you just said, which is that it can be writing the personal can open a door and then become an encumbrance, and that it can be a relief to let it go.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I love that, because I think that's true.
Yeah.
You know, you make an observation, and then that's what you want to be writing about, and it doesn't always have to be the burden of you behind it.
Exactly. I you know, the essays that are more personal in nature, I sometimes, even in Cold Snap, I feel uncomfortable about them. You know, it doesn't feel right. Like a treacle, you know, I think of that kind of a sticky kind mm-hmm. of. And the personal for me can become like that. Just too sticky, too cloying. The essays that go beyond that, those are the ones, as a reader and as a writer, I completely lock into, like a clear light. Like, mm-hmm. okay, this is, okay, here I am. The air it's clearer up here.
Right.
Whereas on the strictly personal level, it's stifling.
I really enjoyed the essay, Mrs. Brock, Alive in the World.
Thank you.
I loved how you try to make sense of your observances of this woman, but also, you know, tie it into the world at large. And she's clearly mentally ill. And I wonder if you could talk. How long was she living near you?
I saw her every day for a number of years. And it took quite a while for me to realize that I had been observing her. She had a kind of a pattern in mm-hmm. the neighborhood. She would pick things up in the street and talk to them. And it was only after repeated exposure that one day I thought, you should pay attention to her.
Mm-hmm.
I never met her, you know. I passed by her a few times with my heart beating very wildly.
That was a wonderful moment in the essay where you and she are about to cross paths. And I thought it was very real that you said you were almost excited in the moment, because you had been observing her.
Yeah.
And you were sort of excited to see what would happen and how she would react to you, and you weren't there.
Yeah, yeah. It's, for me, you know, on this planet, as a human being, the encounters that we almost have are very meaningful. Maybe that's a strange way to put it, but I think everyone, we do know these people. They do affect us, whether we ever talk to that person or not. And I think that's a remarkable, remarkable thing that I don't often read about. And in a city like any city, I think these kinds of near encounters, or a different kind of encounter, they happen all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they affect us. So that essay came out of, I respect her tremendously. I'm also a little afraid of her.
Sure, yeah. and what she represents about our potential madness. Do you mind if I read the last sentence from the essay?
Sure.
Kind of gives away your conclusions, but you wrote, "I will go my whole life without understanding who she is or what people are, why some of us are different, why some of us are broken." That struck me as such a fitting end to this piece, but also kind of a statement about why we write. Mm-hmm. You know, I will go my whole life without understanding. You know, and it's almost like, I don't know if that's true for you, but I think for me, when I write, it's about trying to understand,
yes,
even though maybe I won't be able to.
Yes. I totally agree. This seems to be what drives us to the page in some ways, trying to make sense, knowing ultimately, at least for me, there is no final comprehensive sense, maybe glimmers. Mm-hmm. And writing gives us those opportunities to articulate, you know, why are we here? Who are these people? Who am I? And the essays, especially the meditative essays, give me time and space to do that, to try to make sense out of these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting connection, and I agree. And the broken part, I think you absolutely nailed it.
Well, I think you nailed it.
Oh, thank you.
You also said in that same lecture that people mark and honor the change in their lives and all around themselves, and that no one wants to live without bearing witness, which I think is a nice way to kind of explain why we start with the personal.
I think of, I think in one of the Civil War poems where Whitman says, "I am the man, I was there." That line has always stuck out for me, really, in my whole life. And of course, he's talking about something very horrific and of great historical importance. But I think that line resonates for all of us in our daily lives. We don't have to go necessarily to Iraq, for mm-hmm. example. I am the man, I am the woman, I was there. We can all say that.
Sometimes I think certain writers might feel like they don't have enough to say.
Yeah.
So what would you say to that kind of writer?
Well, I think it was Flannery O'Connor who said in a wonderful book, Mystery and Manners, that if you've lived to the age of 18 or something, that you have all the life material you'll ever need. Now, it doesn't mean that, of course, that the writer has immediate access. That she may not have a form or a voice yet, but it's there. And other writers like Emily Dickinson and Franz Kafka, who outwardly didn't lead dramatic, exciting lives, but obviously their inner lives were tumultuous and cosmic, and you know, and I think that's tremendously informative.
You mentioned Emily Dickinson. Now, you write fiction and nonfiction, and you've written plays. Do you write poetry?
Yes. Uh-huh.
You do.
Yeah.
Do you publish your poetry?
Yes, just individual poems here and there. When I was younger, that's the only thing I wanted to do, was be a poet.
So how do you know when you have an idea what kind of form it will take? Do you...
I think of it in terms of tone. You know, that working in the tone of a novel is different than working in the tone of a play, working in the tone of an essay. So I think of it tonally, mm-hmm. and the poem is something else entirely. And so I feel I inhabit tone. And of course, the arc of a novel is a bit longer, so I have to live inside the tone of a novel for years. Essays, the span is briefer. And poems, a totally different kind of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry's, that's the fundament. I mean, it's everything comes out of that for me. So I devour poetry as a reader. It's, you know, my primary touchstone.
You had another essay in Cold Snap as Yearning called The Dark Hangnails of God. And it's sort of about crows. It's certainly full of crows and sort of the way that they inspire you. And then there were crows also in The Mover of Bones. You compare them to the small dark marks you see in books, which I enjoyed. But I was also really struck by your noticing crows. Are they important to you?
They are. They are. Especially when I was living in Omaha. A winter landscape like we have right now, they just stood out. Which isn't a very original thing to say, but they just... They're regal somehow. And when my wife and I have a tiny place in the woods in northern Michigan, so on the weekend I'll often drive up there, and of course as the woods get denser, you look up in the trees and there are hawks and crows, and they're watching the world, you know. And they're remarkable. They're very intelligent.
I read that while you were writing The Mover of Bones, you listened, in your words, obsessively to the music of Gustav Mahler. Do you write with music as a habit?
I don't. The only exception was when I was zeroing in on the end of The Mover of Bones, where I listened to the last movement of Das Lied. My German pronunciation isn't very good. Der Abschied, the farewell. So I listened to that over and over and over again.
Did you happen to come upon it while you were writing the book, or were you already familiar with it?
I was already familiar with Mahler. He's oceanic, you know. A tremendous influence. And Mahler, you know, the first Das Lied von der Erde, the Songs of the Earth, or Song of the Earth, I think it is. That too helped structurally with the book, because they all have voices, obviously, the different characters. And Mahler was very helpful, a helpful model. You mm-hmm. know.
So, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on I've finished a draft to a new novel,
and not part of the trilogy.
Not part of it's more set more in Michigan, and. And it'll be, I need to revise that considerably. And a new novel. So two novels, I'm kind of going back and forth. Uh-huh. The working title of the first one is The Least Cricket of Evening. And the one I'm working on now is called Water and Abandon. So they're both set in Michigan. They could be another trilogy. I'm beginning to think in those terms for whatever reason. So another cycle of novels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what writers maybe have influenced you.
Sure. Well, my favorite living poet is W.S. Merwin. Mm-hmm. I just love his work, and I also deeply respect and admire him as a person. I invited him to the college where I teach years ago. He's just a huge influence on my writing life. I have a CD of his poems, which I listen to over and over and share with students whenever I can. So he's probably the biggest influence. But I love William Gass, his novel, The Tunnel, uh-huh. which is really an impossible book, but it's just magnificent and disturbing and bizarre and stylistically incredible. Don DeLillo, Annie Dillard, mm-hmm. the essay, Cynthia Ozick.
What are you reading now?
Talking about writers, I love Larry Brown. Mm-hmm. So I was rereading Faye, mm-hmm. his novel.
It's a fantastic novel.
You like that?
I love that novel.
It's a really haunting book.
It is.
Yeah. And Thomas Merton's Zen in the Birds of Appetite. I'm really, my kind of hobby, which is really kind of, is spiritual reading. Simone Weil, Gravity right. and Grace, I turn to that over and over. And I read scripture a lot. I read the New Testament for the stories as much as anything. I mean, it's apart from all of the baggage of religion, and I find them just remarkable stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really like to read all kinds of different things on spirituality, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, it doesn't really matter, mm-hmm. Hindu.
My last question for you is for writers who might be listening. Do you have any advice for them as to what they might do if they get stuck in their work or a piece of writing refuses to move forward?
That's a perennial... A very important question, and I always go back to the habit of art. That if you're, I think John Ashbery says this somewhere too, that if you get in the habit will carry you over. Even when you don't want to write or you don't feel particularly fruitful, the habit will carry you through, especially when you're working on something like a novel. You know, some days you just won't want to write. But if the habit is entrenched enough, you'll do it because it's a habit.
Mm-hmm.
And Isaac Dennison, out of Africa, she has the best single piece of advice about writing I ever heard. Write every day without hope or despair.
Mm.
And so it's kind of a zen-like state, but if you make it a part of your life, you won't worry so much about your feelings about the work, because those come and go. But if it's a habit, you put your time in each day. As far as I can tell, that's the only way to complete a novel.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very
You're
much.
You're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Robert Vivian. My second guest this afternoon is local Burlington business owner Norbert Ender, who owns the store Speaking Volumes on Pine Street. Norbert Ender was born in Austria, but has lived in Switzerland, New York City, upstate New York, and Vermont. He was classically trained as a chef in Switzerland and has worked in the antique business. Speaking Volumes is his Burlington-based secondhand business, from which he sells everything from books to records to the occasional antique sewing machine. I spoke to Norbert in early February from the loft of the store that he runs with the help of his daughter, Anaï. I asked him to describe Speaking Volumes for the benefit of anyone who's never been in the store.
Speaking Volumes, it's a wild mixture. They're kind of, well, since I opened in 2007, December 2007, kind of taken on a little life on its own. I originally wanted to be down here because I focus on online sales. It's
right.
The core of my business. I'm a bookseller.
Right.
With an excessive sense of collecting other stuff. Anything media related, like music, and then paper related, so paperweights, little knickknacks.
Right.
Any kind of photo, old pictures, stereo viewing cards, old images on photographs, postcards, tintype from 19th century tintypes way back, 1850s and onward. Artwork, prints, vintage prints, regional as well as international stuff. Mm-hmm. Anything that kind of strikes my fancy.
Yeah. How do you organize the store?
I try to group it together as it comes at me. Things have to be filed and put into place as they come in, and it's always totally unexpected.
Right.
Whether it's, I have a vintage sewing machine that I just couldn't resist because of the color and the vintage. I sold a bakery scale the other day.
Oh, wow.
I'm a trained chef. And so I'm always very drawn to anything food-related.
Right.
Whether it's a chocolate mold or any kind of food-related item, commercial machinery and stuff.
Yeah.
To go back to the initial question, how I would... So it's a real mishmash of stuff
of
that
stuff.
Just catches my fancy. Since I'm an online seller, my first intention here was... as a sales space, storage, and office space. When I took over the space here, there was a ceiling in here, actually, that I tried to insulate, but that turned out to be not feasible. It actually started falling down, so I ended up redesigning the whole space. I put up these walls here that was open into this next door warehouse, closed this off, took out the ceiling, rearranged all the wiring, put a window in, put a glass door in, put the entrance up front there.
Right, it looks great.
Took out some separation walls downstairs, just opened everything up wide open. Insisted on the sunflower yellow on the walls. I just love it.
It's really bright and beautiful, and it's great with the artwork.
And it does match with the artwork quite well, even though I had to put my foot down a little bit on that. On the right-hand side as you come in, that's our guest wall. Here, that's where all the changing artwork takes place. We have changing shows here. There's some locally made woodcut prints. Aaron Evans made those. Uh-huh. And those are right there by the door. And yeah, there's and then Naki Goran, the photo booth owner, we had a champagne reception on Friday here, which was quite a success.
Oh, great.
It was great. People came out in spite of the snow squalls.
Yeah.
I always say
so. So that was going to be one of my questions. Can you talk a little bit about American Photo Booth? And that's a book.
It's a book.
By Naki Goranin?
Goranin, yeah.
Okay,
she's
Goranin.
A local author and photo historian.
Okay.
She approached me last year to help her do some translation work on some research that she was involved in for her new book that she's writing on early tintypes, 19th century photo process. And we tracked down a photo machine from 1894 that is on display in the German Museum in Munich, and they sent her a spec sheet of those. It's like a four-page chemical analysis of all the chemicals involved from that particular machine, and
wow.
So I helped to translate that, and so we kind of, one thing led to the other. Turns out she has this fabulous piece in storage, mm-hmm. and so we somehow managed to bring it in here, took it out of storage. We're able to locate some film strips, authentic film strips, which have been discontinued to be manufactured, so they're kind of hard to track down.
Yeah.
Got some chemicals back up and running, tweaked a little bit. And it's working fabulous.
Like, with all the original types of materials?
Oh, yes, yes. Ah. It's just the exposures are great. They're not. It's not a digital booth, so it's a real authentic chemical process with fixers and stabilizers. So, I mean, the whole...
Do your customers have access to it at any time?
Oh, yeah. At any time. We open 7 days a week. So.
And what are your hours?
We are here from, officially 10 to 5 on Sundays, from 3 to 4. From 9 to 3, but usually people can catch me here earlier or sometimes later appointment. And it's up and running, and people actually have been taking advantage of it, people coming specifically to take pictures.
Now, where is her booth from?
That came up from New York City, I believe.
Oh, okay.
She thinks that actually Andy Warhol used it at one of his ventures there. And it's...
Really? That's so
cool. Yeah, and there are only about 200 of this vintage left in the United States. This is probably the only one here in New England, and definitely the only one in Vermont that's up and running.
Yeah.
So it's hope, and we're trying to get word out, and hopefully to bringing somebody down and cramming a few people in there. We had as many as 6 people fit in there and getting their face on those...
Strips,
yeah. So there are 4 exposures per each strip, and they're all individual, so you can actually have a little.
And what do you charge for the strip?
We're charging $4 for the strip, which is nominal. I do want to keep it accessible, like everything else in the store here. We try to keep it reasonable.
Okay.
Since we're the only true used bookstore left here in town. We don't carry any remnants. Books, all our books are recycled, reused.
Mm-hmm. And you get them from people who bring them in? Or
we buy them some. I've been collecting books since I remember.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And it's just, taking on a life of its own.
Well, I was going to ask you what you think. This is actually two different businesses, mm-hmm. but what is your opinion about sort of the big box store booksellers and the internet booksellers?
Well, they certainly serve their purpose. You know, I don't want to be mean or anything. Everybody deserves a chance to try it. They serve a purpose. People like to go in and browse, and I think they're doing a good job. Certainly. Bookstores are a good thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Do you feel like the used book business is a little safer place to be right now than an independent bookseller of new books?
I never really considered that. I'm a single parent. Well, she just turned 19 today, actually. So, but still, that disqualified.
Well, you have been a single parent.
Right. So, and being in the used, in the recycling business, as I like to see it, and reuse business, kind of given me the freedom and the liberty to adjust my lifestyle around it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a friend who I think is sort of doing what you're describing, you're having started as doing from home, mm-hmm. and she goes to a lot of used sales and, you know, church basement
right.
type sales and looks for sort of the unappreciated rare book that will
right.
make a good sale. Do you still do that sort of thing?
I like to, but I really don't have the time. The
yeah.
store really does take a lot of time. On the flip side, I mean, I used to own a big antique center in Whitehall.
Okay.
From 93 till 2000. So I've been doing, but then there was more antiques and collectibles, and then I took my business back home. Again, the inventory has been just sitting stale in storage, so uh-huh. I kind of, that's how I came about to move into this space.
Uh-huh.
The advantage, again, having a physical retail location, people do know I'm here, they do know I buy stuff. Stuff finds me so easily.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
and
it's a good, great
and,
space.
And that's the advantage when you do have a retail location, so people find you. And there's tons of stuff out there.
And you're probably the only bookstore with a gas pump in your office.
that's actually a prop that's all made of wood.
Oh.
It's a real piece of art that I inherited from a dear friend of mine down in New York City. It was
that's great.
In a gallery down in New York, and then found its way here into Burlington.
I love it.
Actually, I have the hose and the nozzle. It's all made of wood. There's no metal part on this gas pump.
Huh.
Look alike. It's deceivingly authentic looking.
Yeah, really. So you sell vinyl.
I sell vinyl.
And
at the urging of my daughter, again.
Oh, okay. Do you enjoy listening to music on vinyl at home?
Oh, not at home, but
no.
here at the shop.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I come in, and then in the morning I usually put on some classical music. I have a huge collection, private collection of classical music, probably in the excess of 4,000 or 5,000
wow.
classical records. That I think a lifetime's not going to be enough,
because yeah.
stuff still keeps coming in, and I just zigzag through all the music genres as they come in. You know, things grab your attention, whether it's some old revived memories, and then you look back
here. Oh, we have that one.
And it's just, it's all out there.
Yeah.
So, and it comes, you know, unannounced, and you better be ready for it.
Oh, wow.
So,
that one's got to be valuable, hey?
It's okay. I probably a reissue.
Meet the Beatles, wow.
Meet the Beatles. We got, yeah, these are the first, second, third issues.
Uh-huh.
These are American issued ones.
Uh-huh.
So they're fairly affordable. They're not the pretty first releases, which again for the collector. We do cater strongly to the collector, the serious collector.
Right.
The rest goes in the dollar box.
Do most new recordings come out on vinyl as well?
A lot of new artists are putting out. Actually, I just got a special friend of mine, Larkin Grimm. This is a limited edition. They only pressed 700 records of this, and it's made in Holland.
Is this a 78?
No, that's a regular 33-speed recording.
Oh, it's just it's a smaller size.
It's a smaller size.
Cool.
But yeah, there's a lot of artists publishing.
Larkin Grimm.
Larkin Grimm, yeah, a new and up-and-coming artist. And she just toured Europe, and they did a special recording.
Where's she
recording.
From?
She's from New York City,
Okay. Oh, where are you from?
I'm Austrian.
You're Austrian.
I'm Austrian by birth, but I came to New York in 86.
Okay.
Worked in the hotel industry.
Do you do a lot of marketing to heighten the awareness of your store?
Locally, I do a little, shameless self-promotion in the form of, we do put on sometimes concerts.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard about our music events for the last couple of years. For July 3rd, our big ones, and the Art Hop also.
Okay.
In the past, we do acoustic nights here occasionally, and real underground.
Mm-hmm.
Great local bands, actually, last summer at the July 3rd party, Eric Smith,
mm-hmm.
Jamaican reggae artist, was performing at Stowe the following day. He came down and did a guest appearance with backup singers, the whole
Wow.
Shebang. It was fabulous.
Yeah. Do you work with, I know that that you underwrite at the Radiator, and work with Big Heavy World in getting some of your artists?
My daughter used to intern with Big Heavy World throughout her high school years there, so she spent like 3 years, something odd years at Big Heavy, so she's very much in tune, and she is also the one who organizes the artist appearances. But yeah, there are very few spaces here in Berlin where you can actually, other than a big
Radio Bean.
The Radio Bean, and there's really not a lot of higher ground. Mm. You've got the other Nectars downtown.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of musicians looking for performance space does not match what's the availability.
Sure.
So I've been continuously approached by very talented local artists on a continuous basis.
Yeah.
And I actually have a waiting list.
Wow.
Yeah. People come in here all the time trying to play here, and we don't pay anything. It's really just for the fun of it.
Yeah.
We have a great sound guy, Wyatt, who works at Advanced Music, another great local store.
Mm-hmm.
Does a lot for local musicians. And yeah, we have top-notch sound system set up and top-notch musicians performing here over the past few years, Pretty and Nice,
mm-hmm.
who are out touring on the road. They've performed here. Jazz guys.
Do you ever have book signings and readings?
The book signing was our first one, yeah, Naki Gorenin. And then today, actually, we just acquired, it's a pre-release, it's going to come out in April, a writer that just moved to town, Eric Sigelstad.
So the greatest myth of rock and roll, the 27th.
Fabulous book. I had the privilege in getting a pre-release copy. Actually, we got 12 of them. I just purchased directly from the author. You can't buy this book anywhere right now, but here. And when we have signed copies.
Oh, great. So is he doing a signing here?
We just met. I just bought a bunch of his books and have him sign them all.
Okay.
And I hope people hear about it and they come here first.
Yeah.
There's some other book signings here in the works. Again, my primary mission here is really to kind of keep busy selling books online, and whatever else kind of happens.
Yeah.
I do rely heavily on artists who do want to participate here to do their own self-promotion and make use of the space that I happily provide. But I kind of rely on them to do the promo and all the other possibilities that are there.
Now, your internet sales, is that done mostly through a certain internet venue? Is it mostly Amazon?
It's mostly through Amazon and eBay.
Okay.
So there's certain things I can't sell through Amazon, obviously. Sometimes I sell some glassware or some books that, you know, they have a different audience.
Mm-hmm.
If they have an ISBN number, Amazon's the way to do it.
Right.
If they're older collectible ones with a more antique audience, so this is, you know, so you have to make this distinction. Those are the two main websites that I sell on.
Mm-hmm. What's your competition?
I don't really pay attention to that.
You don't?
I think the more the merrier.
Yeah.
I wish there'd be more book shops in town. I hated to see North Country Books go.
Oh, yeah.
They were great. I hung out there. I buy books.
Yeah.
I still do. Crow is left up on Church Street.
The
I
Crow.
Hope they're there for a long time to come.
Yeah.
And then Borders and all the others. As I said, I like people going out and buy books and recycle them. I know some of the publishers don't like me, you know, recycle their books. They'd like to keep cranking out new stuff.
Yeah.
I think there's plenty of good old stuff out there. You've got to read your classics. And why spend $25 on a new classic if you can find a used one here for $3.50 or $4? The same thing.
Mm-hmm.
A nice reading copy, pass it on when you're done with it, or bring it back, they'll buy it back.
Mm-hmm. Do you have rules about what kind of books you'll take, like what condition or how old, how new?
Generally, I do buy bulk, so people bring it in by the bag, by the box full. I buy single items, of course, if they're interesting enough. I do, obviously, can't compete on that level with the big box stores in terms of Stephen King, very common. Brokeback Mountain, it's been out for 6 months, then they show up on Amazon at a penny plus the shipping. So these are things I really, you know, I don't make enough, you know, on one or two items, they sell them by the thousands at 25 cents profit margin. So I'm obviously not competing with them. So I do look for more scientific titles. I sell a lot to universities, colleges, collectors. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do look for some sophisticated titles, quality books. I just came across a nice Virginia Woolf first edition, 1933, English printing. So it was not an American release, but it was actually a true English first edition. Mm. It's in bad shape, but still.
What was the book?
It's Flush, a biography by Virginia Woolf, by the Hoggart Press, which is quite rare. So it's a quite nice book.
Well, this is a great rare book. I'm wondering if you have a favorite rare book memory of something that came into your possession that you either still have or that you sold.
Roughing It by Mark Twain, first edition.
Oh, wow.
And I sold it, and then shortly after the movie came out, and the price rose dramatically. Tough luck, but I did have it, and it was great. And I do like Mark Twain; is one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah. What do you like to read? I mean, you just said Mark Twain, but do you read contemporary stuff too?
I read a lot of contemporary stuff. Mostly, I just read the biography of Salt.
Oh yeah, that was
a great book.
Excellent.
Yeah, Poland. The Omnivore Dilemma, I just finished that. So anything food related, I read cookbooks, of which I have thousands.
Now, did he write The Botany of Desire as well?
Yes, I think he did. I think so, yeah. Ackerman. So anything with historic context. I'm a history buff.
Yeah.
American history, New England history, Vermont. So many books, so little time to read.
Right. So you sell books and you sell music. I'm curious if you've ever done any writing or if you've performed at all.
I've been trying to write a cookbook for the last, I don't know how many years. Still doing research. I'm a little bit intimidated by it. My command of the English language. If you want to write a book, you may have to set a high standard for yourself.
I think that writing a cookbook with an Austrian background would be a real benefit.
Right, but at the same time, yeah, you try to maintain a professional standard.
Sure. Because
since I'm so critical of everybody else on that subject, all these semi-professionals on TV, it's kind of a travesty.
Where did you train?
I trained in Austria. I did a four-year program. In Austria, and started with splitting cumin lengthwise and all the other gimmicks they play on you when you start as an apprentice in the kitchen. Then you work your way up. And then I moved to Switzerland, and I worked and lived there for 4 years before I moved to New York City.
You make use of MySpace and Facebook in doing your advertising and marketing?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So how's that worked out for you?
It's fairly recent that we started that. My daughter is taking care of that.
Okay.
I guess fine. Yeah. It's a fun medium.
Yeah.
It is a college town. A lot of kids are on it, so I think it's a good opportunity for us to get word out and be recognized. And I want these people to come in and discover us. We are a little bit off the beaten track.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really should be asked to pay that much money for retail space up on Church Street. It's prohibitively expensive, the square footage up there. But again, I'm quite comfortable down here. It has its advantages, reasonable rent, and then we also don't disturb anyone when we do have live music down here.
Are there areas of the store that you'd like to change or strengthen?
Not really. As I said, I enjoy the thing, the dynamic that it has on its own. So new stuff new stuff comes in every day, and it really dictates what direction it takes. People ask me, where did you find the photo booth? Like, I didn't plan on it. It just came to me, Never know.
So do you have anything else that you know that's coming up that you want to mention?
Coming up, we're having a record exchange with the UVM radio station. We're planning that for March. It's not official yet, but it's probably going to happen on the 28th of March, perhaps.
Here in the store?
Next door, in the warehouse, I sometimes make use of my neighbor's space. He's gracious enough and offers his facility here to do whatever on the weekends when they're not utilizing it. So we come up with stuff. to keep it interesting.
And is that where you have the live music?
We usually do the live music outside. The music set up within the warehouse, but since we're not licensed to accommodate more than
a certain number of people,
so we can't really perform indoors. The music's usually set up within the bay door, the loading docks, and then the back parking lot serves as the audience space.
Well, my last question, I'm just curious from the perspective of a bookstore owner, if you have any advice for writers who are trying to break into the business.
Come on down. I'll buy your book. I'll put it on the shelf.
Okay.
These are the only new books that I would carry in my store. I have right now two titles. It's Naki Koran's photo book, booth book, and the 27th, The Greatest Myth of Rock and Roll.
Okay.
And I'd like to do book signings and book readings here. If they take the initiative, I'm inviting them to come down, talk to me, take the initiative, and make it happen for themselves.
All right, well, so
pretty
that's
lucky.
Good for new writers, newly published authors in Burlington to know that you're here.
Or anyone here in Vermont, come
and
on out.
Your address is 377
Pine Street. You're right next to Meyer Spiegel's, across from Harvest Bread Bakeries.
And what about on the internet? Where do they find you on the internet?
Speaking Volumes, VT, for Vermont.com. That'll take you right to our website with all the other subcategories. And drop me an email.
Okay. Now, if people go on Amazon and want to buy specifically from you or look at your content, do they do that through Speaking Volumes Vermont?
Yep. We'll have our link for the Amazon link right on our website, so they can log on to our website, click on the Amazon link, and we'll take you to our inventory.
Okay. All right. Awesome.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed those interviews with Norbert Ender and Robert Vivian. Tune in next week to hear a conversation with the novelist Anita Diamant, whose book The Red Tent became a publishing phenomenon thanks to word-of-mouth support from readers and book groups. We'll discuss her latest, The Last Days of Dogtown, as well as her upcoming novel, due out this fall, Day After Night. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. For more information, visit autismsupportdaily.com or call 985-8773. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my first guest, Robert Vivian. In his work with students, he occasionally distributes postcards from small towns and asks each student to write a note on that card to a fictional recipient. Look at the postcard and imagine you're traveling across the country and you've landed in this small town. Use the postcard as a trigger and write to someone. It could be someone who's wronged you in the past or a beloved person. You might be writing this postcard due to a situation that you're fleeing. Dear Randy, hello from the middle of nowhere. I'm in a diner. Icicles are hanging down from the roof. I'm driving to Santa Fe. I have $20 in my pocket. I can't stop thinking about the last time we spoke, etc. Invent a situation and write. Let the postcard be a trigger and lose yourself in the creative act. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Monday afternoon from 2 to 3 at theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. Stay tuned now. Coming up next is Cheryl Willoughby with The World of Music.